But the idea seems perfectly rational.
You don't even need to leave a note, her friend says. She can see his reflection in the window again, ghostly. The fact that you did it down here will be your letter to the world.
True.
You know too much about yourself now to go on living, her friend points out as she returns her gaze to the swimming fish. You know too much, and all of it is bad. Then it hastens to add, which isn't to say you're a horrible person. She thinks,
no, not horrible, just useless. Blackish.
The truck is coming, the gangsta large. As Jerome Robinson's sister steps toward the curb, ready to meet it, her face lights in an eager smile. 7. Dr. Felix Babineau is wearing a $1,000 suit beneath the white coat that goes flying out behind him as he strides down the hallway of the bucket. But he now needs a shave worse than ever, and his usually elegant white hair is in disarray. He ignores a cluster of nurses who are standing by the duty desk and talking in low, agitated tones. Nurse Wilmer approaches him.
Dr. Babineau, have you heard?
He doesn't even look at her, and Norma has to sidestep quickly to keep from being bowled over. She looks after him in surprise. Babineau takes the red Do Not Disturb card he always keeps in the pocket of his exam coat, hangs it on the doorknob of room 217, and goes in. Brady Hartsfield does not look up. All of his attention is fixed on the game console in his lap, where the fish swim back and forth. There is no music. He has muted the sound. Often, when he enters this room, Felix Babineau disappears and Dr. Z takes his place. Not today. Dr. Z is just another version of Brady, after all, a projection, and today Brady is too busy to project. His memories of trying to blow up the Mingo Auditorium during the Round Here concert are still jumbled, but one thing has been clear since he woke up. The face of the last person he saw before the lights went out. It was Barbara Robinson, the sister of Hodges' nigger lawn boy. She was sitting almost directly across the aisle from Brady. Now she's here, swimming with the fish they share on their two screens. Brady got Scapelli, the sadistic cunt who twisted his nipple. Now he will take care of the Robinson bitch. Her death will hurt her big brother, but that's not the most important thing. It will put a dagger in the old detective's heart. That's the most important thing. The most delicious thing. He comforts her, tells her she's not a horrible person. It helps to get her moving. Something is coming down MLK. He can't be sure what it is because a down deep part of her is still fighting him, but it's big. Big enough to do the job.
Brady, listen to me. Z-Boy called.
Z-Boy's actual name is Brooks, but Brady refuses to call him that anymore.
He's been watching, as you instructed, that cop, ex-cop, whatever he is.
Shut up. Not raising his head, his hair tumbled across his brow. In the strong sunlight, he looks closer to 20 than 30.
Babineau, who is used to being heard and who still has not entirely grasped his new subordinate status, pays no attention. Hodges was on Hilltop Court yesterday, first at the Ellerton house and then snooping around the one across the street where—
I said shut up.
Brooks saw him get on a number 5 bus, which means he's probably coming here. And if he's coming here, he knows.
Brady looks at him for just a moment, his eyes blazing, then returns his attention to the screen. If he slips now, allows this educated idiot to divert his concentration, but he won't allow it. He wants to hurt Hodges. He wants to hurt the nigger lawn boy. He owes them, and this is the way to do it. Nor is it just a matter of revenge. She's the first test subject who was at the concert, and she's not like the others, who were easier to control. But he is controlling her. All he needs is 10 more seconds, and now he sees what's coming for her. It's a truck, a big black one. Hey, honey, Brady Hartsfield thinks, your ride is here. 8.
Barbara stands on the curb, watching the truck approach, timing it, but just as she flexes her knees, hands grab her from behind.
Hey, girl, what's up?
She struggles, but the grip on her shoulders is strong, and the truck passes by in a blare of Ghost Face Killer. She whirls around, pulling free, and faces a skinny boy about her own age, wearing a Todd Hunter High letter jacket. He's tall, maybe 6.5 feet, so she has to look up. He has a tight cap of brown curls and a goatee. Around his neck is a thin gold chain. He's smiling. His eyes are green and full of fun.
You good-looking. That's a fact as well as a compliment. But not from around here, correct? Not just like that. And hey, didn't your mom ever tell you not to jaywalk the block?
Leave me alone!
She's not scared. She's furious. He laughs.
And tough! I like a tough girl. Want a slice and a Coke?
I don't want anything from you.
Her friend is left, probably disgusted with her.
It's not my fault, she thinks. It's this boy's fault. This lout.
Lout. A blackish word if ever there was one. She feels her face heat up and drops her gaze to the fish on the Zap-It screen.
They will comfort her. They always do. To think she almost threw the game console away after that man gave it to her. Before she found the fish. The fish always take her away, and sometimes they bring her friend. But she only gets a momentary look before the console vanishes. Poof, gone.
The lout has got it in his long-fingered hands and is staring down at the screen, fascinated.
Whoa, this is old school.
It's mine, Barbara shouts. Give it back.
Across the street, a woman laughs and yells in a whiskey voice.
Tell him, sister. Bring down that hard neck.
Barbara grabs for the Zap-It. Tall boy holds it over his head, smiling at her.
Give it back, I said. Stop being a prick.
More people are watching now, and tall boy plays to the audience. He jinks left, then stutter steps to the right. Probably a move he uses all the time on the basketball court, never losing that indulgent smile. His green eyes sparkle and dance. Every girl at Todd Hunter is probably in love with those eyes. And Barbara is no longer thinking about suicide or being blackish or what a socially unconscious bag of waste she is. Right now she's only mad, and him being cute makes her madder. She plays varsity soccer at Chapel Ridge, and now she hoiks her best penalty kick into tall boy's shin. He yells in pain, but it's somehow amused pain, which infuriates her even more because that was a really hard kick, and bends over to grab his ouchie. It brings him down to her level, and Barbara snatches the precious rectangle of yellow plastic. She wheels, skirt flaring, and runs into the street.
Honey, look out!
The whiskey-voiced woman screams. Barbara hears a shriek of brakes and smells hot rubber. She looks to her left and sees a panel truck bearing down on her, the front end heeling to the left as the driver stamps on the brake. Behind the dirty windshield, his face is all dismayed eyes and open mouth. She throws up her hands, dropping the Zap-It. All at once, the last thing in the world Barbara Robinson wants is to die. But here she is, in the street, after all, and it's too late. She thinks, my ride is here.
9. Brady shuts down the Zap-It and looks up at Babineau with a wide smile.
Got her, he says. His words are clear, not the slightest bit mushy. Let's see how Hodges and the Harvard Jungle Bunny like that.
Babineau has a good idea who she is, and he supposes he should care, but he doesn't. What he cares about is his own skin. How did he ever allow Brady to pull him into this? When did he stop having a choice?
It's Hodges I'm here about. I'm quite sure he's on his way right now to see you.
Hodges has been here many times, Brady says, although it's true the old dead rat hasn't been around for a while. He never gets past the catatonic act.
He started putting things together. He's not stupid. You said as much yourself.
Did he know Z-Boy when he was just Brooks? He must have seen him around here when he came to visit you.
No idea. Brady is wrung out, sated. What he really wants now is to savor the death of the Robinson girl, then take a nap. There's a lot to be done.
Great things are afoot. But at the moment, he needs rest.
He can't see you like this, Babineau says. Your skin is flushed, and you're covered with sweat. You look like someone who just ran the city marathon.
Then keep him out. You can do that. You're the doctor, and he's just another half-bald buzzard on Social Security. These days, he doesn't even have the legal authority to ticket a car at an expired parking meter.
Brady's wondering how the nigger lawn boy will take the news. Jerome.
Will he cry?
Will he sink to his knees? Will he rend his garments and beat his breast?
Will he blame Hodges?
Unlikely, but that would be best. That would be wonderful.
All right, Babineau says. Yes, you're right. I can do that.
He's talking to himself as much as to the man who was supposed to be his guinea pig. That turned out to be quite the joke, didn't it?
For now, at least. But he must still have friends on the police, you know. Probably lots of them.
I'm not afraid of them, and I'm not afraid of him. I just don't want to see him. At least not now, Brady smiles. After he finds out about the girl, then I want to see him. Now get out of here.
Babineau, who is at last beginning to understand who is the boss, leaves Brady's room. As always, it's a relief to do that as himself, because every time he comes back to Babineau after being Dr. Z, there's a little less Babineau to come back to.
10.
Tanya Robinson calls her daughter's cell for the fourth time in the last 20 minutes, and for the fourth time gets nothing but Barbara's chirpy voicemail.
Disregard my other messages, Tanya says after the beep. I'm still mad, but mostly what I am right now is worried sick. Call me. I need to know you're okay.
She drops her phone on her desk and begins pacing the small confines of her office. She debates calling her husband and decides not to. Not yet. He's apt to go nuclear at the thought of Barbara skipping school, and he'll assume that's what she's doing. Tanya at first made that assumption herself when Mrs. Rossi, the Chapel Ridge attendance officer, called to ask if Barbara was homesick. Barbara has never played hooky before, but there's always a first time for bad behavior, especially with teenagers. Only she never would have skipped alone, and after further consultation with Mrs. Rossi, Tanya has confirmed that all of Barb's close friends are in school today. Since then, her mind has turned to darker thoughts, and one image keeps haunting her. The sign over the crosstown expressway the police use for amber alerts. She keeps seeing Barbara Robinson on that sign, flashing on and off like some hellish movie marquee. Her phone chimes the first few notes of Ode to Joy, and she races to it, thinking, thank God. Oh, thank God. I'll ground her for the rest of the win- Only it's not her daughter's smiling face in the window. It's an ID. City Police Department, Main Branch. Terror rolls through her stomach and her bowels loosen. For a moment, she can't even take the call, because her thumb won't move. At last, she manages to press the green accept button and silence the music. Everything in her office, especially the family photo on her desk, is too bright. The phone seems to float up to her ear. Hello? She listens. Yes, this is she. She listens, her free hand rising to cover her mouth and stifle whatever sound wants to come out. She hears herself ask, are you sure it's my daughter? Barbara Rosalind Robinson? The policeman who has called to notify her says yes. He's sure. They found her ID in the street. What he doesn't tell her is that they had to wipe off the blood to see the name.
11. Hodges knows something's amiss as soon as he steps out of the skyway that connects Kiner Memorial proper to the Lakes Region Traumatic Brain Injury Clinic, where the walls are painted a soothing pink and soft music plays day and night. The usual patterns have been disrupted, and very little work seems to be getting done. Lunch carts stand marooned, filled with congealing plates of noodly stuff that might once have been the cafeteria's idea of Chinese. Nurses cluster, murmuring in low tones, One appears to be crying. Two interns have their heads together by the water fountain. An orderly is talking on his cell phone, which is technically cause for suspension, but Hodges thinks he's safe enough. No one is paying him any mind.
At least Ruth Scapelli is nowhere in sight, which might improve his chances of getting in to see Hartsfield. It's Norma Wilmer at the duty desk, and along with Becky Helmington, Norma was his source for all things Brady before Hodges quit visiting room 217.
The bad news is that Hartsfield's doctor is also at the duty desk. Hodges has never been able to establish a rapport with him, although God knows he's tried.
He ambles down to the water fountain, hoping Babineau hasn't spotted him and will soon be off to look at PET scans or something, leaving Wilmer alone and approachable. He gets a drink, wincing and placing a hand to his side as he straightens up, then speaks to the interns.
Is something going on here? The place seems a little riled up.
They hesitate and glance at each other. Can't talk about it, says intern one. He still has the remains of his adolescent acne and looks about 17.
Hodges shudders at the thought of him assisting in a surgery job more difficult than removing a thumb splinter.
Something with a patient? Hartsfield, maybe? I only ask because I used to be a cop and I'm sort of responsible for putting him here.
Hodges, says intern two, is that your name?
Yeah, that's me.
You caught him, right?
Hodges agrees instantly, although if it had been left up to him, Brady would have bagged a lot more in Mingo Auditorium than he managed to get at City Center.
No, it was Holly and Jerome Robinson who stopped Brady before he could detonate his devil's load of homemade plastic explosive.
The interns exchange another glance, and then one says,
Hartsfield's the same as ever, just gorking along. It's Nurse Ratchet.
Intern two gives him an elbow. Speak no ill of the dead, asshole, especially when the guy listening might have loose lips.
Hodges immediately runs a thumbnail across his mouth as if sealing his dangerous lips shut.
Intern one looks flustered. Head Nurse Scapelli, I mean. She committed suicide last night.
All the lights in Hodges' head come on, and for the first time since yesterday, he forgets that he's probably going to die. Are you sure?
Sliced her arms and wrists and bled out, says Two. That's what I'm hearing, anyway.
Did she leave a note?
They have no idea.
Hodges heads for the duty desk.
Babineau is still there, going over files with Wilmer, who looks flustered at her apparent battlefield promotion, but he can't wait.
This is Hartsfield's dirt. He doesn't know how that can be, but it has Brady written all over it. The fucking suicide prince.
He almost calls Nurse Wilmer by her first name, but instinct makes him shy from that at the last moment. Nurse Wilmer, I'm Bill Hodges, a thing she knows very well. I worked both the City Center case and the Mingo Auditorium thing. I need to see Mr. Hartsfield.
She opens her mouth, but Babineau is there ahead of her.
Out of the question. Even if Mr. Hartsfield were allowed visitors, which he is not by order of the District Attorney's Office, he wouldn't be allowed to see you. He needs peace and calm. Each of your previous unauthorized visits has shattered that.
News to me, Hodges says mildly. Every time I've been to see him, he just sits there. Bland as a bowl of oatmeal.
Norma Wilmer's head goes back and forth. She's like a woman watching a tennis match.
You don't see what we see after you've left.
Color is rising in Babineau's stubble-flecked cheeks, and there are dark circles under his eyes.
Hodges remembers a cartoon from his Sunday school Living with Jesus workbook back in the prehistoric era when cars had fins and girls wore bobby socks. Brady's doc has the same look as the guy in the cartoon, but Hodges doubts if he's a chronic masturbator. On the other hand, he remembers Becky telling him that the neuro doctors are often crazier than the patients.
And what would that be? Hodges asks. Little psychic tantrums? Do things have a way of falling over after I'm gone? The toilet in his bathroom flushes by itself, maybe?
Ridiculous. What you leave is psychic wreckage, Mr. Hodges. He's not so brain-damaged that he doesn't know you're obsessed with him. Malevolently so. I want you to leave. We've had a tragedy, and many of the patients are upset.
Hodges sees Wilmer's eyes widen slightly at this and knows that the patients capable of cognition, many here in the bucket or not, have no idea that the head nurse is offed herself.
I only have a few questions for him, and then I'll be out of your hair.
Babineau leans forward. The eyes behind his gold-rimmed glasses are threaded with snaps of red.
Listen closely, Mr. Hodges. One, Mr. Hartsfield is not capable of answering your questions. If he could answer questions, he would have been brought to trial for his crimes by now. Two, you have no official standing. Three, if you don't leave now, I will call security and have you escorted from the premises.
Hodges says,
Pardon me for asking, but are you all right?
Babineau draws back as if Hodges has brandished a fist in his face.
Get out!
The little clusters of medical personnel stop talking and look around.
Gotcha, Hodges says. Going. All good.
There's a snack alcove near the entrance to the skyway. Intern two is leaning there, hands in pockets.
Ooh, baby, he says. You've been schooled.
So it would seem. Hodges studies the wares in the nibble-a-bit machine. He sees nothing in there that won't set his guts on fire, but that's okay. He's not hungry.
Young man, he says, without turning around, if you would like to make $50 for doing a simple errand that will cause you no trouble, then get with me.
Intern two, a fellow who looks like he might actually attain adulthood at some point in the not-too-distant future, joins him at the nibble-a-bit.
What's the errand?
Hodges keeps his pad in his back pocket, just as he did when he was a detective first class. He scribbles two words, call me, and adds his cell number. Give this to Norma Wilmer once Smaug spreads his wings and flies away.
Intern two takes the note and folds it into the breast pocket of his scrubs.
Then he looks expectant. Hodges takes out his wallet. 50 is a lot for delivering a note, but he has discovered at least one good thing about terminal cancer. You can toss your budget out the window.
12. Jerome Robinson is balancing boards on his shoulder under the hot Arizona sun when his cell phone rings. The houses they are building, the first two already framed, are in a low-income but respectable neighborhood on the southern outskirts of Phoenix. He puts the boards across the top of a handy wheelbarrow and plucks his phone from his belt, thinking it will be Hector Alonso, the job foreman. This morning, one of the workmen, a workwoman, actually, tripped and fell into a stack of rebar. She broke her collarbone and suffered an ugly facial laceration. Alonso took her to the St. Luke's ER, appointing Jerome temporary foreman in his absence. It's not Alonso's name he sees in the little window, but Holly Gibney's face. It's a photo he took himself, catching her in one of her rare smiles.
Hey, Holly, how are you? I have to call you back in a few. It's been a crazy morning here, but...
I need you to come home, Holly says. She sounds calm, but Jerome knows her of old, and in just those six words he can sense strong emotions held in check, fear chief among them. Holly is still a very fearful person. Jerome's mother, who loves her dearly, once called fear Holly's default setting.
Home? Why? What's wrong?
His own fear suddenly grips him.
Is it my dad? Mom? Is it Barbie?
It's Bill, she says. He has cancer. A very bad cancer. Pancreatic. If he doesn't get treatment, he'll die. He'll probably die anyway, but he could have time, and he told me it was just a little ulcer because...
She takes a great ragged breath that makes Jerome wince.
Because of Brady fracking Hartsfield.
Jerome has no idea what connection Brady Hartsfield can have to Bill's terrible diagnosis, but he knows what he's seeing right now. Trouble. On the far side of the building site, two hard-headed young men, Habitat for Humanity College volunteers like Jerome himself, are giving a beeping, backing cement truck conflicting directions. Disaster looms.
Holly, give me 5 minutes and I'll call you back.
But you'll come, won't you? Say you'll come, because I don't think I can talk to him about this on my own, and he has to get into treatment right away.
5 minutes, he says, and kills the call. His thoughts are spinning so fast that he's afraid the friction will catch his brains on fire, and the blaring sun isn't helping.
Bill? With cancer? On one hand, it doesn't seem possible. But on the other, it seems completely possible. He was in top form during the Pete Sauber's business, where Jerome and Holly partnered with him. But he'll be 70 soon, and the last time Jerome saw him before leaving for Arizona in October, Bill didn't look all that well. Too thin. Too pale. But Jerome can't go anywhere until Hector gets back. It would be like leaving the inmates to run the asylum. And knowing the Phoenix hospitals, where the ERs are overrun 24 hours a day, he may be stuck here until quitting time. He sprints for the cement truck, bawling, "Hold up! Hold up! For Jesus' sake!" at the top of his lungs. He gets the clueless volunteers to halt the cement truck they've been misdirecting less than 3 feet from a freshly dug drainage ditch, and he's bending over to catch his breath when his phone rings again. "Holly, I love you," Jerome thinks, pulling it from his belt once more. "But sometimes you drive me absolutely bugfuck." Only this time, it's not Holly's picture he sees. It's his mother's. Tanya's crying. "You have to come home," she says. And Jerome has just long enough to think of something his grandfather used to say. Bad luck keeps bad company. It's Barbie, after all.
13. Hodges is in the lobby and headed for the door when his phone vibrates. It's Norma Wilmer. "Is he gone?" Hodges asks. Norma doesn't have to ask who he's talking about.
"Yes. Now that he's seen his prized patient, he can relax and do the rest of his rounds."
"I was sorry to hear about Nurse Capelli." "It's true. He didn't care for her, but it's still true."
"I was, too. She ran the nursing staff like Captain Bly ran the Bounty, but I hate to think of anyone doing that. You get the news, and your first reaction is, 'Oh, no, not her, never.' It's the shock of it. Your second reaction is, 'Oh, yes, that makes perfect sense. Never married, no close friends, not that I knew of, anyway. Nothing but the job, where everybody sort of loathed her.'"
"All the lonely people," Hodges says, stepping out into the cold and turning toward the bus stop. He buttons his coat one-handed and then begins to massage his side.
"Yes, there are a lot of them. What can I do for you, Mr. Hodges?"
"I have a few questions. Could you meet me for a drink?" There's a long pause. Hodges thinks she's going to tell him no. Then she says,
"I don't suppose your questions could lead to trouble for Dr. Babineau."
"Anything is possible, Norma."
"That would be nice, but I guess I owe you one regardless. For not letting on to him that we know each other from back in the Becky Helmington days. There's a watering hole on Revere Avenue. Got a clever name. Bar Bar Black Sheep. And most of the staff drinks closer to the hospital. Can you find it?"
"Yeah."
"I'm off at 5. Meet me there at 5:30. I like a nice cold vodka martini."
"It'll be waiting."
"Just don't expect me to get you in to see Hartsfield. It would mean my job. Babineau was always intense, but these days he's downright weird. I tried to tell him about Ruth, and he blew right past me. Not that he's apt to care when he finds out."
"Got a lot of love for him, don't you?" She laughs.
"For that, you owe me 2 drinks.
2 it is. He's slipping his phone back into his coat pocket when it buzzes again. He sees the call is from Tanya Robinson, and his thoughts immediately flash to Jerome, building houses out there in Arizona. A lot of things can go wrong on building sites. He takes the call. Tanya's crying, at first too hard for him to understand what she's saying, only that Jim is in Pittsburgh and she doesn't want to call him until she knows more. Hodges stands at the curb, one palm plastered against his non-phone ear to muffle the sound of traffic. "Slow down, Tanya, slow down. Is it Jerome? Did something happen to Jerome?"
"No, Jerome's fine. Him I did call. It's Barbara. She was in Lowtown."
"What in God's name was she doing in Lowtown and on a school day?"
"I don't know. All I know is that some boy pushed her into the street and a truck hit her. They're taking her to Kina Memorial. I'm on my way there now."
"Are you driving?"
"Yes. What does that have to do with..."
"Get off the phone, Tanya, and slow down. I'm at Kina now. I'll meet you in the ER." He hangs up and heads back to the hospital, breaking into a clumsy trot. He thinks, "This goddamn place is like the Mafia. Every time I think I'm out, it pulls me back in." 14. An ambulance with its lights flashing is just backing into one of the ER bays. Hodges goes to meet it, pulling out the police ID he still keeps in his wallet. When the paramedic and the EMT pull the stretcher out of the back, he flashes the ID with his thumb placed over the red retired stamp. Technically speaking, this is a felony crime, impersonating an officer. And consequently, it's a fiddle he uses sparingly, but this time it seems absolutely appropriate. Barbara is medicated, but conscious. When she sees Hodges, she grasps his hand tightly.
Bill, how did you get here so fast? Did Mom call you?
Yeah, how are you?
I'm okay. They gave me something for the pain. They say I have a broken leg. I'm going to miss the basketball season, and I guess it doesn't matter because Mom will ground me until I'm, like, 25.
Tears begin to leak from her eyes. He doesn't have long with her, so questions about what she was doing on MLK Avenue, where there are sometimes as many as 4 drive-by shootings a week, will have to wait. There's something more important. Barb, do you know the name of the boy who pushed you in front of the truck? Her eyes widen. Or get a good look at him. Could you describe him?
Pushed? Oh, no, Bill. No, that's wrong.
Officer, we gotta go, the paramedic says. You can question her later.
Wait!
Barbara shouts and tries to sit up. The EMT pushes her gently back down, and she's grimacing with pain, but Hodges is heartened by that shout. It was good and strong. What is it, Barb?
He only pushed me after I ran into the street. He pushed me out of the way. I think he might have saved my life, and I'm glad.
She's crying hard now, but Hodges doesn't believe for a minute it's because of her broken leg.
I don't want to die, after all. I don't know what was wrong with me.
We really have to get her in an exam room, Chief, the paramedic says. She needs an X-ray.
Don't let them do anything to that boy,
Barbara calls as the AMBO guys roll her through the double doors.
He's tall. He's got green eyes and a goatee. He goes to Todd Hunter.
She's gone, the doors clapping back and forth behind her. Hodges walks outside, where he can use his cell phone without being scolded, and calls Tanya back. I don't know where you are, but slow down and don't run any red lights getting here. They just took her in and she's wide awake. She has a broken leg.
That's all? Thank God. What about internal injuries?
That's for the doctors to say, but she was pretty lively. I think maybe the truck just grazed her.
I need to call Jerome. I'm sure I scared the hell out of him. And Jim needs to know.
Call them when you get here. For now, get off your phone.
You can call them, Bill.
No, Tanya, I can't. I have to call someone else. He stands there, breathing out plumes of white vapor, the tips of his ears going numb. He doesn't want the someone else to be Pete, because Pete is a tad pissed at him right now, and that goes double for Izzy James. He thinks about his other choices, but there's only one, Cassandra Sheen. He partnered up with her several times when Pete was on vacation, and on one occasion when Pete took 6 weeks of unexplained personal time. That was shortly after Pete's divorce, and Hodges surmised he was in a spin-dry center, but never asked, and Pete never volunteered the information. He doesn't have Cassie's cell number, so he calls Detective Division and asks to be connected, hoping she's not in the field. He's in luck. After less than 10 seconds of McGruff the crime dog, she's in his ear. Is this Cassie Sheen, the Botox queen?
Billy Hodges, you old whore. I thought you were dead.
Soon enough, Cassie, he thinks. I'd love to bullshit with you, hon, but I need a favor. They haven't closed the Strike Avenue station yet, have they?
Nope. It's on the docket for next year, though, which makes perfect sense. Crime in Lowtown? What crime, right?
Yeah, safest part of the city. They may have a kid in for booking, and if my information is right, he deserves a medal instead.
Got a name?
No, but I know what he looks like. Tall, green eyes, goatee. He replays what Barbara said and adds, he could be wearing a Todd Hunter high jacket. The arresting officers probably have him for pushing a girl in front of a truck. He actually pushed her out of the way, so she only got clipped instead of mashed.
You know this for a fact?
Yeah. This isn't quite the truth, but he believes Barbara. Find out his name and ask the cops to hold him, okay? I want to talk to him.
I think I can do that.
Thanks, Cassie. I owe you one. He ends the call and looks at his watch.
If he means to talk to the Todd Hunter kid and still keep his appointment with Norma, time is too tight to be messing around with the city bus service. One thing, Barbara said, keeps replaying in his mind.
I don't want to die after all. I don't know what was wrong with me.
He calls Holly.
15. She's standing outside the 7-Eleven near the office, holding a pack of Winstons in one hand and plucking at the cellophane with the other. She hasn't had a cigarette in almost 5 months, a new record, and she doesn't want to start again now. But what she saw on Bill's computer has torn a hole in the middle of a life she has spent the last 5 years mending. Bill Hodges is her touchstone, the way she measures her ability to interact with the world, which is only another way of saying that he is the way she measures her sanity. Trying to imagine her life with him gone is like standing on top of a skyscraper and looking at the sidewalk 60 stories below. Just as she begins to pull the strip on the cellophane, her phone rings. She drops the Winstons into her purse and fishes it out. It's him. Holly doesn't say hello. She told Jerome she didn't think she could talk to him on her own about what she's discovered, but now, standing on this windy city sidewalk and shivering inside her good winter coat, she has no choice. It just spills out.
I looked on your computer, and I know that snooping's a lousy thing to do, but I'm not sorry. I had to, because I thought you were lying about it just being an ulcer, and you can fire me if you want. I don't care, just as long as you let them fix what's wrong with you.
Silence at the other end. She wants to ask if he's still there, but her mouth feels frozen and her heart is beating so hard she can feel it all over her body. At last he says,
Halls, I don't think it can be fixed.
At least let them try.
I love you, he says. She hears the heaviness in his voice, the resignation. You know that, right?
Don't be stupid. Of course I know.
She starts to cry. I'll try the treatment, sure, but I need a couple of days before I check into the hospital, and right now I need you. Can you come and pick me up?
Okay.
Crying harder than ever, because she knows he's telling the truth about needing her, and being needed is a great thing. Maybe the great thing.
Where are you?
He tells her, then says, something else.
What?
I can't fire you, Holly. You're not an employee. You're my partner. Try to remember that.
Bill?
Yeah?
I'm not smoking.
That's good, Holly. Now come on over here. I'll be waiting in the lobby. It's freezing outside.
I'll come as fast as I can while still obeying the speed limit.
She hurries to the corner lot where she parks her car. On the way, she drops the unopened pack of cigarettes into a litter basket.
16.
Hodges sketches in his visit to the bucket for Holly on the ride to the Strike Avenue police station, beginning with the news of Ruth Scapelli's suicide and ending with the odd thing Barbara said before they wheeled her away.
I know what you're thinking, Holly says, because I'm thinking it too, that it all leads back to Brady Hartsfield.
The suicide, Prince. Hodges has helped himself to another couple of painkillers while waiting for Holly, and he feels pretty much okay. That's what I'm calling him. Got a ring to it, don't you think?
I guess so. But you told me something once.
She's sitting bolt upright behind the wheel of her Prius, eyes darting everywhere as they drive deeper into Lowtown. She swerves to avoid a shopping cart someone has abandoned in the middle of the street.
You said coincidence doesn't equal conspiracy. Do you remember saying that?
Yeah, it's one of his faves. He has quite a few.
You said you can investigate a conspiracy forever and come up with nothing if it's actually just a bunch of coincidences all strung together. If you can't find something concrete in the next 2 days, if we can't, you need to give up and start those treatments. Promise me you will.
It might take a little longer to... She cuts him off.
Jerome will be back, and he'll help. It will be like the old days.
Hodges flashes on the title of an old mystery novel, Trent's Last Case, and smiles a little.
She catches it from the corner of her eye, takes it for acquiescence, and smiles back, relieved. 4 days, he says.
3. No more. Because every day you don't do something about what's going on inside you, the odds get longer. And they're long already. So don't start your poopy bargaining stuff, Bill. You're too good at it.
Okay, he says. 3 days, if Jerome will help. Holly says,
he will. Then let's try to make it 2.
17. The Strike Avenue cop shop looks like a medieval castle in a country where the king has fallen and anarchy rules. The windows are heavily barred. The motor pool is protected by chain-link fencing and concrete barriers. Cameras bristle in every direction, covering all angles of approach. And still, the gray stone building has been gang-tagged, and one of the globes hanging over the main doors has been shattered. Hodges and Holly empty the contents of their pockets and Holly's purse into plastic baskets and go through a metal detector that beeps reproachfully at Hodges' metal watchband. Holly sits on a bench in the main lobby, which is also being scanned by multiple cameras, and opens her iPad. Hodges goes to the desk, states his business, and after a few moments is met by a slim, gray-haired detective who looks a little like Lester Freeman on The Wire, the only cop show Hodges can watch without wanting to throw up. Jack Higgins, the detective says, offering his hand. Like the book writer, only not white. Hodges shakes with him and introduces Holly, who gives a little wave and her usual muttered hello before returning her attention to her iPad. I think I remember you, Hodges says. You used to be at Marlborough Street Station, didn't you, when you were in uniform?
A long time ago, when I was young and randy. I remember you, too. You caught the guy who killed those 2 women in McCarran Park.
That was a group effort, Detective Higgins.
Make it Jack. Cassie Sheen called. We've got your guy in an interview room. His name is Derice Neville. Higgins spells the first name.
D-E-R-E-E-C-E.
We were going to turn him loose anyway. Several people who saw the incident corroborate his story. He was jiving around with a girl. She took offense and ran into the street. Neville saw the truck coming, ran after her, tried to push her out of the way, mostly succeeded. Plus, practically everyone down here knows this kid. He's a star on the Todd Hunter basketball team, probably going to get an athletic scholarship to a Division I school. Great grades, honor student.
What was Mr. Great Grades doing on the street in the middle of a school day? Ah, they were all out.
Heating system at the high school shit the bed again. 3rd time this winter, and it's only January. The mayor says everything's cool down here in the low. Lots of jobs, lots of prosperity, shiny, happy people. We'll see him when he runs for re-election, riding in that armored SUV of his.
Was the Neville kid hurt?
Scraped palms and nothing else. According to a lady across the street, she was closest to the scene, he pushed the girl and then, I quote, went flying over the top of her like a big-ass bird.
Does he understand he's free to go?
He does, and agreed to stay. Wants to know if the girl's okay. Come on. Have your little chat with him, and then we'll send him on his way, unless you see some reason not to.
Hodges smiles. I'm just following up for Miss Robinson. Let me ask him a couple of questions, and we're both out of your hair.
18. The interview room is small and stifling hot, the overhead heating pipes clanking away. Still, it's probably the nicest one they've got because there's a little sofa and no perp table with a cuff bolt sticking out of it like a steel knuckle. The sofa has been mended with tape in a couple of places, and that makes Hodges think of the man Nancy Alderson says she saw on Hilltop Court, the one with the mended coat. Derice Neville is sitting on the sofa. In his chino pants and white button-up shirt, he looks neat and squared away. His goatee and gold neck chain are the only real dashes of style. His school jacket is folded over one arm of the sofa. He stands when Hodges and Higgins come in and offers a long-fingered hand that looks designed expressly for working with a basketball. The pad of the palm has been painted with orange antiseptic. Hodges shakes with him carefully, mindful of the scrapes, and introduces himself. You're in absolutely no trouble here, Mr. Neville. In fact, Barbara Robinson sent me to say thanks and make sure you were okay. She and her family are longtime friends of mine.
Is she okay?
Broken leg,
Hodges says, pulling over a chair. His hand creeps to his side and presses her.
It could have been a lot worse. I'm betting she'll be back on the soccer field next year. Sit down, sit down.
When the Neville boy sits, his knees seem to come almost up to his jawline.
It was my fault, in a way. I shouldn't have been goofing with her, but she was just so pretty and all. Still, I ain't blind.
He pauses, corrects himself.
Not blind. What was she on? Do you know?
Hodges frowns. The idea that Barbara might have been high hasn't crossed his mind, although it should have. She's a teenager, after all, and those years are the age of experimentation. But he has dinner with the Robinsons 3 or 4 times a month, and he's never seen anything in her that registered as drug use. Maybe he's just too close. Or too old. What makes you think she was on something?
Just her being down here, for one thing. Those were Chapel Ridge duds she was wearing. I know, because we play 'em twice every year. Blow 'em out, too. And she was like in a daze, standing there on the curb near Mama Star's, that fortune-telling place, looking like she was going to walk right out into traffic.
He shrugs.
So I chatted her up, teased her about jaywalking. She got mad and went all Kitty Pryde on my ass. I thought that was cute, so then...
He looks at Higgins, then back at Hodges.
This is the fault part, and I'm being straight with you about it, okay?
Okay, Hodges says.
Well, look, I grabbed her game. Just for a joke, you know? Held it up over my head. I never meant to keep it. So then she kicked me. Good hard kick for a girl. And grabbed it back. She sure didn't look stoned then.
How did she look, Therese? The switch to the boy's first name is automatic.
Oh, man, mad. But also scared. Like she just figured out where she was, on a street where girls like her, ones in private school uniforms, don't go, especially by themselves. MLK Avenue? Come on, I mean, bitch, please.
He leans forward, long-fingered hands clasped between his knees, face earnest.
She didn't know I was just playing, you see what I mean? She was like in a panic. Get me?
I do, Hodges says, and although he sounds engaged, at least he hopes so, he's on autopilot for the moment, stuck on what Neville has just said. I grabbed her game. Part of him thinks it can't be connected to Ellerton and Stover. Most of him thinks it must be. It's a perfect fit.
That must have made you feel bad.
Neville raises his scratched palms toward the ceiling in a philosophical gesture that says, what can you do?
It's this place, man. It's the low. She stopped being on cloud 9 and realized where she was is all. Me, I'm getting out as soon as I can. While I can. Gonna play Div 1, keep my grades up so I can get a good job afterward if I aren't good enough to go pro. Then I'm getting my family out. It's just me and my mom and my 2 brothers. My mom's the only reason I've got as far as I have. She ain't never let none of us play in the dirt.
He replays what he just said and laughs.
She heard me say ain't never, she'd be in my face.
Hodges thinks, kid's too good to be true. Except he is. Hodges is sure of it, and doesn't like to think what might have happened to Jerome's kid's sister if Therese Neville had been in school today.
Higgins says, you were wrong to be teasing that girl, but I have to say you made it right. Will you think about what almost happened if you get an urge to do something like that again?
Yes, sir, I sure will.
Higgins holds a hand up. Rather than slap it, Neville taps it gently with a slightly sarcastic smile. He's a good kid, but this is still Low Town, and Higgins is still Popo. Higgins stands.
Are we good to go, Detective Hodges?
Hodges nods his appreciation at the use of his old title, but he isn't quite finished.
Almost. What kind of game was it, Therese?
Old school.
No hesitation.
Like a Game Boy. But my little brother had one of those. Mom got it in a rumble sale, or whatever they call those things. And the one the girl had wasn't the same. It was bright yellow. I know that. Not the kind of color you'd expect a girl to like. Not the ones I know, at least.
Did you happen to see the screen?
Just a glance. It was a bunch of fish swimming around.
Thanks, Therese. How sure are you that she was high on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being absolutely positive?
Well, say 5. I would have said 10 when I walked up to her, because she acted like she was going to walk right out into the street. There was a big-ass truck coming, a lot bigger than the panel job that come along behind and whumped her. I was thinking not coke or meth or molly, more something mellow, like ecstasy or pot.
But when you started goofing with her, when you took her game, Doris Neville rolls his eyes. Man, she woke up fast. Okay, Hodges says. All set. And thank you. Higgins adds his thanks, then he and Hodges start toward the door.
Detective Hodges.
Neville is on his feet again, and Hodges practically has to crane his neck to look at him.
You think if I wrote down my number, you could give it to her?
Hodges thinks it over, then takes his pen from his breast pocket and hands it to the tall boy who probably saved Barbara Robinson's life. 19. Holly drives him back to Lower Marlborough Street. He tells her about his conversation with Doris Neville on the way.
In a movie, they'd fall in love,
Holly says when he finishes. She sounds wistful. Life is not a movie, Holly. He stops himself from saying Holly Berry at the last second. This is not a day for levity.
I know, she says. That's why I go to them.
I don't suppose you know if Zap-It consoles came in yellow, do you? As is often the case, Holly has the facts at her fingertips.
They came in 10 different colors, and yes, yellow was one of them.
Are you thinking what I'm thinking? That there's a connection between what happened to Barbara and what happened to those women on Hilltop Court?
I don't know what I'm thinking. I wish we could sit down with Jerome the way we did when Pete Saubers got into trouble. Just sit down and talk it all out.
If Jerome gets here tonight, and if Barbara's really okay, maybe we can do that tomorrow.
Tomorrow's your second day,
she says as she pulls to the curb outside the parking lot they use.
The second of three.
Holly?
No, she says fiercely. Don't even start. You promised.
She shoves the gear shift into park and turns to face him.
You believe Hartsfield has been faking, isn't that right?
Yeah. Maybe not from the first time he opened his eyes and asked for his dear old mommy, but I think he's come a long way back since then. Maybe all the way. He's faking the semi-catatonic thing to keep from going to trial. Although you'd think Babineau would know. They must have tests, brain scans and things.
Never mind that. If he can think, and if he were to find out that you delayed treatment and died because of him, how do you think he'd feel?
Hodges makes no answer, so Holly answers for him.
He'd be happy, happy, happy. He'd be fracking delighted.
Okay, Hodges says. I hear you. The rest of today and two more, but forget about my situation for a minute. If he can somehow reach out beyond that hospital room, that's scary.
I know. And nobody would believe us. That's scary, too. But nothing scares me as much as the thought of you dying.
He wants to hug her for that, but she's currently wearing one of her many hug-repelling expressions, so he looks at his watch instead. I have an appointment, and I don't want to keep the lady waiting.
I'm going to the hospital. Even if they won't let me see Barbara, Tanya will be there, and she'd probably like to see a friendly face.
Good idea. But before you go, I'd like you to take a shot at tracking down the Sunrise Solutions bankruptcy trustee.
His name is Todd Schneider. He's part of a law firm 6 names long. Their offices are in New York. I found him while you were talking to Mr. Neville.
You did that on your iPad?
Yes.
You're a genius, Holly.
No, it's just computer research. You were the smart one to think of it in the first place. I'll call him if you want.
Her face shows how much she dreads the prospect. You don't have to do that. Just call his office and see if you can make an appointment for me to talk to him. As early tomorrow as possible. She smiles.
All right.
Then her smile fades. She points to his midsection.
Does it hurt?
Only a little. For now, that's true. The heart attack was worse. That is true, too, but may not be for long. If you get in to see Barbara, say hi for me.
I will. Holly watches him cross to his car, noting the way his left hand goes to his side after he turns up his collar. Seeing that makes her want to cry, or maybe howl with outrage. Life can be very unfair. She's known that ever since high school, when she was the butt of everyone's joke, but it still surprises her. It shouldn't, but it does.
20.
Hodges drives back across town, fiddling with the radio, looking for some good hard rock and roll. He finds the Knack on BAM 100 singing My Sharona and cranks the volume. When the song ends, the DJ comes on, talking about a big storm moving east out of the Rockies. Hodges pays no attention. He's thinking about Brady, and about the first time he saw one of those Zap-It game consoles. Library Al handed them out. What was Al's last name? He can't remember, if he ever knew it at all, that is. When he arrives at the watering hole with the amusing name, he finds Norma Wilmer seated at a table in back, far from the madding crowd of businessmen at the bar who are bellowing and backslapping as they jockey for drinks. Norma has ditched her nurse's uniform in favor of a dark green pantsuit and low heels. There's already a drink in front of her. I was supposed to buy that, Hodges says, sitting down across from her.
Don't worry, she says. I'm running a tab, which you will pay.
Indeed I will.
Babineau couldn't get me fired or even transferred if someone saw me talking to you here and reported back to him. But he could make my life difficult. Of course, I could make his a bit difficult, too.
Really?
Really. I think he's been experimenting on your old friend, Brady Hartsfield. Feeding him pills that contain God knows what. Giving him shots as well. Vitamins, he says.
Hodges stares at her in surprise. How long has this been going on?
Years. It's one of the reasons Becky Helmington transferred. She didn't want to be the white cap on Ground Zero if Babineau gave him the wrong vitamin and killed him.
The waitress comes. Hodges orders a Coke with a cherry in it. Norma snorts.
A Coke? Really? Put on your big boy pants, why don't you?
When it comes to booze, I spilled more than you'll ever drink, honey pie, Hodges says. What the hell is Babineau up to? She shrugs.
No idea. But he wouldn't be the first doc to experiment on someone the world doesn't give shit one about. Ever hear of the Tuskegee syphilis experiment? The U.S. government used 400 black men like lab rats. It went on for 40 years, and so far as I know, not a single one of them ran a car into a bunch of defenseless people.
She gives Hodges a crooked smile.
Investigate, Babineau. Get him in trouble. I dare you.
It's Hartsfield I'm interested in, but based on what you're saying, I wouldn't be surprised if Babineau turned out to be collateral damage.
Then hooray for collateral damage.
It comes out collateral damage, and Hodges deduces she's not on her first drink. He is, after all, a trained investigator. When the waitress brings his Coke, Norma drains her glass and holds it up.
I'll have another, and since the gentleman's paying, you might as well make it a double.
The waitress takes her glass and leaves. Norma turns her attention back to Hodges.
You said you have questions. Go ahead and ask while I can still answer. My mouth is a trifle numb and will soon be number.
Who is on Brady Hartsfield's visitors list? Norma frowns at him.
Visitors list? Are you kidding? Who told you had a visitors list?
The late Ruth Scapelli. This was just after she replaced Becky as head nurse. I offered her $50 for any rumors she heard about him, which was the going rate with Becky, and she acted like I just pissed on her shoes. Then she said, you're not even on his visitors list.
Huh.
Then just today, Babineau said,
some bullshit about the DA's office. I heard it, Bill. I was there.
The waitress sets Norma's new drink in front of her. And Hodges knows he'd better finish up fast before Norma starts to bend his ear about everything from being underappreciated at work to her sad and loveless love life. When nurses drink, they have a tendency to go all in. They're like cops that way. You've been working the bucket for as long as I've been coming there.
A lot longer. 12 years.
Years. She raises her glass in a toast and swallows half of her drink.
And now I have been promoted to head nurse. At least temporarily. Twice the responsibility at the same old salary, no doubt.
Seen anybody from the DA's office lately?
Nope. There was a whole briefcase brigade at first, along with pet doctors just itching to declare the son of a bitch competent. But they went away discouraged once they saw him drooling and trying to pick up a spoon.
Came back a few times just to double check. Fewer briefcase boys every time, but nothing lately. So far as they're concerned, he's a total